Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Earthlets, and welcome to the first 2000 AD Thrillcast of 2016. Happy New Year. Hope you all had a fantastic festive period that was stuffed with thrill power. I, for one, got some very nice Judge Dredd cufflinks, which, gone down very well. This is the first Thrillcast of the new year, and we have an absolutely packed year full of some top announcements and also some very special guests coming up, which I can't tell you about at the moment, but yeah. They're going to be pretty gaffle-bet. Now, we've been away for a few weeks, as has 2000 AD itself, but last week's Prog 1962 was our thrill-powered return to weekly publication. We've also this month got a new Judge Dredd magazine coming out, Dredd Magazine 368, which is out on the 20th of January. We've also got this month a couple of fantastic graphic novel releases. First off is Aquila. I was corrected on the pronunciation of Aquila by Gordon Rennie himself. That's our kind of dark Roman Avenger Soul Hunter series set in ancient Rome. That's coming out in paperback this month. We've also got the second volume of Pat Mills and Simon Davis's The Slain, The Britannia Chronicles, which is beautiful, beautiful comics. That's out in hardback in the UK. Really recommend that that you pick that up. Also, and we're going to be talking to the author Michael Carroll in a minute, we've got a new prose novella out from Abaddon Books, which is Judge Dredd Year 2, The Righteous Man, which goes right back to the moment when Judge Dredd had arrested his own brother for corruption and what that meant for him. Also, in this episode, we're going to be talking to Ian Edgington about a couple of things that he's got coming up in 2016. So very much kind of Janus-like looking forward, while also looking back a little bit, at the thrill-powered goodies that we have in store for Squawk's Deck Thargo everywhere. As always, do make sure that you let us know what you think about the Thrillcast. Either leave a review on iTunes or drop us a line at thrillcast@2000adonline.com. That's thrillcast@2000adonline.com. Whether it's feedback, whether it's a question for Tharg himself, or whether, you know, you just want to pass the time of day, do please drop us a line. And looking forward to hearing from you. And if you do have a question for Tharg, then we'll have a bumper session of Ask Tharg in next fortnight's edition. Now, without much further ado, let's crack on with our guests. As I said, Judge Dredd Year 2, The Righteous Man is a new prose novella by Michael Carroll, which is out today from Amazon and also from rebellionstore.com. And so, joining us on Skype, I'm delighted to welcome Michael Carroll to the Thrillcast. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael. It's nice to be here. I love what you've done with the place.
Thank you very much. We just decorated.
It'll be nice when it's finished. Yeah. See where you're going with it.
Right, let's talk about some of the stuff that you've got coming up for 2018, because you've been writing Dredd for quite a little while now, haven't you?
Yeah, it's 5 years this month since my first Dredd appeared.
Oh, right, happy anniversary.
Oh, thank you very much. I expect a cake in the post any day now. it's five years, I think, yeah. My sense of time is very weak. There's now and there's before now. And other people have got things like months and calendars, but I don't hold this fancy new age hippie stuff, you know.
Let's just talk a little bit how you came to be writing for 2000 AD, because you'd had a successful line of YA superhero novels before, hadn't you?
Yes, yes, and still do that. It's still ongoing. It's tough after all these years. But yeah, I've been writing full time since 1999, when my former employers wisely decided to to let me go my way. And comics on and off. I did one, well, I think the first thing I ever published was in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And then 10 years later, a one-page strip in Solar Wind.
Oh, yes. Paul Scott's wonderful kind of retro kids comic. I did work for that as well. That was a lot of fun.
You did, yes. It was yesterday's comic today at tomorrow's prices. It was wonderful. So, yeah, myself and Dave Evans collaborated on a one-page strip there. And it was one of those throwaway things. But I'd always wanted to do more comics, but I always felt that I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
You know, when you read, you know, all the greats, when you spend your whole life reading, well, most of like reading 2000 AD, it's kind of intimidating that, you know, I could never write anything as good as even as good as, I was going to throw in the name of one of the less good stories there, but I thought I better not. But eventually you have to say, no, I mean, you know, just because I can't do it now doesn't mean I won't learn along the way. So, yeah, so I'm not sure. I think it was right about the year 2000-ish. Hmm. I met John Higgins at an event in Dublin, and I was saying, oh, I've always wanted to do comics. And he said, well, you know, you should. Just do it. Talking about it won't achieve anything. And so I started sending in ideas and scripts, and one of them got quite close to being published. It was when Andy Diggle was Parag's representative on Earth. And it didn't... He sent me back a whole page of notes on the script, and I think I learned more from that than from anything else I'd ever read before. He was just so incisive. He nailed the problems of the story so perfectly. And then I was working on a rewrite, and then Andy left, and then things fell apart. But eventually, the Future Shock was accepted by the current representative on Earth, and bit by bit, two Future Shocks, three Tales from Black Cuisines, and suddenly Parag is asking me to pitch ideas for Judge Dredd. I'm going, okay, that was quick.
Well, yeah, that's a fairly brief apprenticeship.
It was, but that said, I mean, at that stage, I published 15 or 16 novels, so I was well used to writing at that stage. So, I mean, luckily my novels weren't the same kind of thing as 2000 AD, but I knew how to get words onto a page and hopefully into the reader's imagination.
So, in terms of stuff that's coming up, just next week, we have the release of your latest Judge Dredd prose novella that we published through Abaddon Books. And that's the Judge Dredd Year 2, The Righteous Man. Do you want to tell us a little something about that, because that's taking a very seminal moment in Dredd's history and kind of extrapolating it outwards.
Exactly. It opens moments after Dredd has arrested his clone brother Rico, which we saw in Prague 30 of 2008 back in 1977. And I already covered that Rico's story in The Third Law, which came out last year, I think it was, or the year before, my second of the novellas. But this one takes it from Dredd's point of view, from Joe Dredd's point of view, because we're in a situation there where he has arrested his brother, who was presumably, everybody else assumed he was a decent judge like Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that immediately casts suspicion on him. So we also have a larger factor in the fact that these are very prominent clone judges. And you know, when most judges aren't clones, what impact does that have on the Justice Department? If they can't trust one of their top judges ever, which is Rico, if he turns out to be a bad guy, does that mean his twin is going to be a bad guy? Mm. Does that mean the whole project is suspect? So that's where it began, where the story takes off from there. I decided that Joe Dredd needed to be, I won't say exiled, but shall we say monitored carefully. He's put into a sector of the city where he's never been before, so he doesn't know anybody, and they're watching him. And then something happens externally, and he gets to go out into the cursed earth. So it's quite fun doing these books because it gives an excuse to go back over the old early Dredd stories, the first few years, and look at things that that was something that was never really followed up on or never explained, or something that maybe was whitewashed out of history. Now, you'll see that in the book itself. I won't give a spoiler, but there's one particular aspect that was never really touched on again. And I thought, you know, let's see if I can make that work within the context of what we have now. So it's a lot of fun. But I think the key thing was it gave me a chance to, again, as I did with my first Dread novella, present Dread as somebody nobody knows. When we see Dread now, he's been on the streets for 50-odd years. And, you know, the average guy on the street would have heard of Judge Dread. But this guy, you know, this time we have him, he's a newbie. It's only his second year, effectively, out of the academy. He doesn't have a reputation yet. So we're letting him build his reputation now. It's a huge amount of fun to him.
Well, that's the thing. It's nice to see the year one and the year two stuff exploring Dredd as a character who isn't as certain and sure of himself as he is later on, because certainly by the point of something like the Apocalypse War in the early 80s, you know, he's very certain of his place in the city and what his reputation is. But in those early days, he's just another judge.
Well, exactly. That's it. He is a judge who is totally untested. Well, not totally, but he has. I think one of the opening scenes, which you put in the first chapter there up on the Nazanin Tumblr site. He's confronted by older judges who basically, you know, they're looking at him thinking, "Who is this upstart, you know, kid?" Because Dredd is, I suppose, physically he's about 20 or 21 years old at that stage. I remember myself when I was 21. I knew nothing. Thought I knew everything, but I knew nothing. So we have Dredd as a, he's wet around the ears, and he's not established. He's not confident in the same way that we see him later. And so it's nice to explore him as, it makes him more human, because it's easy to write Dredd as an unstoppable killing machine. And that's fun to do. I have nothing wrong with that. I love those stories. But you want him to be a guy who thinks, well, hang on a minute, you know, I should hold back a little. When he's in the Cursed Earth, he's with two other judges, one of whom is basically effectively assigned to watch him. He is not in charge. He is not the boss. Obviously, because it's a Judge Dredd story, he takes charge. He sort of becomes the leader of a particular situation. But he is an other judge, as you say. I think he only differs from the rest of the judges in the fact that he's got an unlikely name and he's taller. So, but it is a lot of fun to write him like that. And I have to say, I loved what the other year one stories have done. Matt's and Al's, though obviously we all take slightly different approaches. But it's nice to present Dredd as fresh. Because in a way, of course, it gives us and the readers a new way to look at Mega City 1. We're so used to the craziness and the madness because Dredd's kind of jaded by it all, so he takes it in stride. But now Dredd can react a little more to how different things are. So, different, I should say, to our world.
Yeah. And as somebody who has written novels and gone on to doing comics... Which do you prefer writing, Dredd as a prose character or Dredd as a comics character?
Oh man, that is a very tough question. I love doing the prose stuff because you can get very deep into a character, you can go into backgrounds, you can throw in stuff that just wouldn't fit into a comic. Comics are very restrictive in the sense that we know we have 6 pages per week for 2000 AD. It has to end on some sort of cliffhanger that'll keep the readers interested, this kind of thing. So that's effectively a chapter is a fixed length. In a book, your chapters can be as long as you want. You put the cliffhanger in at the end. You don't have to force it in at a particular place. That mightn't sound like a big deal, but in terms of pacing, it actually is pretty big. That said, I love doing the comics because when the artists, the colorists, and the letterers present their final work, it shows the story in a whole new light. I always have mental pictures of how everything looks, and they always look amazing, exciting, wonderful. And then you get someone like, you know, PJ Holmes or Nick Grossman coming along, and you go, "Oh yeah, that's what I should have been writing." Their interpretation of my words is better than my interpretation of my words. I mean, I've worked with some, as you know, I've worked with some incredible artists on Dredd. I've been very lucky, and I'm still a fanboy at heart. I'm still, you know, in some ways, I'm still the the same 10-year-old kid who was buying 2000 AD back in 77. And I still get excited when I see the comics. And sometimes I'm still excited when I see the ones with my names on them too. You know? But I know I love both. The prose gives me a lot more freedom in terms of what I can do. But the end result, I mean, you know, Dread is effectively a visual medium. Mm. It's comic. I suppose you could say, and this might not be logical or sensical, but there's more depth in the prose, but there's more breadth and width in the comic. That sounds almost profound.
Almost, yes.
Don't delete that bit.
And we do get people who, you know, when we publicise the prose novels, some people say, "Oh, but why bother? You know, Dread is a comic. Dread is a comic." What would you say to somebody who hasn't been tempted to try Dread in prose form, but you think should pick up The Righteous Man?
Well, I think people should pick it up because it's it adds a little more background to Dredd, as you'll say, and to Dredd's world. Yeah. But these aren't totally 100% standalone novels. I don't want to give it away, but there's a minor character mentioned in The Righteous Man. It's you know, a chap I invented, who also appears in the upcoming story Ghosts, which, by the way, has some of the best art I have seen in many years. On 2008, Mark Sexton's work is just amazing. But yeah, so we can actually add with the prose novels, we can add more to the background of stuff. So yeah, the novels aren't throwaway. They're not like the, with all respect, not like the Virgin novels from the 90s, which had no direct impact on what was being done in the comic with myself and Al and Matt and you know, people like Alec Worley and so on writing the novellas. We also write the comics, so you know, we're building on our own worlds. I mean, it isn't necessary to read one or both, but you know, people should because they're fun. And yeah, The Righteous Man also has some quite exciting scenes, I think. I mean, yeah, okay, it's awesome. That's why people should read it.
Better. Yes. So if anyone wants to pick up The Righteous Man, they can order it on Amazon for Kindle, both in the UK and the US. It's also going to be available from today on rebellionstore.com. You can download it DRM-free from the Abandoned Stores, the Abandoned Books and Solaris Books website there. Other Judge Dredd novellas are available. You already mentioned Al Ewing and Matt Smith. And there's a load of the Virgin novels from the 1990s on there, which are a great read. Now, moving back to comics, next week in Judge Dredd magazine number 368, you've got a new Judge Dredd story starting with Nick Percival on art. Tell us a little bit about the Gyre.
The Gyre, or the Gyre. I'm still not sure how to pronounce it. Yeah, it is a... It takes Dredd to a part of the world that we haven't seen before in any Dredd or Dredd World-related stories. Hmm. Also, as because it is my sort of fifth anniversary, it ties in with my first published Dredd story a little bit. I don't want to spoil too much. It's a tiny, tiny bit. No one needs to worry about it or know about it, but it was one of my first published story in the magazine was magazine 306, a story called Blood Culture, brilliant art by John Davis Hunt.
Yeah,
and that was the first one I wrote. So there's a character in that who shows up as one of the minor characters in the Gyre. But what I have to say about the Gyre is that Nick Percival has been sending me, you know, some of the artwork. This is here crying with how beautiful it is. The man is incredible. He can make, okay, it's not a pretty place, the Gyre. It's a part of the world that's pretty horrible. It's packed with mutants and horror. It's, you know, it's horrible, but he paints it so well, you're thinking, this is beautiful. No, it's horrible, but it's beautiful at the same time. It is wonderful stuff. I just get blown away by how good his artwork is. His the level of detail and texture he sends is just phenomenal. It says like individual panels or whole pages. It's just like pouring over them for ages, going, "Oh, look at this bit. Oh, look at that," and thinking, "Yep, I wouldn't be an artist for all the tea in China. It's just too hard. And it also makes me feel guilty. I get this with most artists, actually. I see, I write a panel description that might be two lines long and it took me a minute to write, if even. And I think, yeah, looking at that panel, yeah, that took the artist several days.
Well, isn't that the worst thing that a writer can do to an artist is just say a few words like huge crowd scene or yes. Massive fight.
Yeah, I've done that myself. I think it was years ago at a convention, John McRae said that he hates seeing a script where it says, you know, panel one, the two planets collide.
Brilliant.
I think it was John who said that. Was it John or PJ? They're at a convention.
Yeah.
And I just thought, yeah, that's why it's better to be the writer. It's easier. I know, yeah, we struggle over various, you know, aspects of the characters and so on and so forth. But let's be honest, you know, it's easier to type Dread on Lawmaster than it is to actually draw the thing. Like, you know, it's just one of those rules. But yeah, just look at the work Nick has done is stunning.
Sure, sure. I mean, with the Gaia or the Jaya, you're taking Dread kind of out of his comfort zone into a new environment. Is that a relatively easy thing to do? Because Mega City 1 is such an intrinsic part of Dread as a character. And he goes out into the Cursed Earth, but the Cursed Earth is its own thing. How difficult is it to find new environments for him to be in?
To be honest, it's really difficult because there have been so many stories over the years, and they're all, everything pretty much that's been done is in continuity. So I can't just pick a place that's always went to before and sort of pretend it's new.
Sure.
So I go with the Jaya, which was inspired by an old documentary I saw years ago. I give it away. It actually happens in the first story. It's easy. It is to figure out what it is. There's the North Pacific Jaya or Gaia.
Yeah.
Is a, it's like a collection of flotsam and jetsam in the middle of the North Pacific, where basically the various currents and eddies drag all the garbage into one location.
Mm.
And I said to myself, well, you know, okay, obviously this is Dread's world, so therefore it's a Sinti jar or a Mega jar or a Newton jar. Basically, there's boats and things like that there. So it's kind of like a small community has formed, and taking Dread away from Mega City 1 also takes away his support network, because there's always a problem with Dread is that if you put him into real danger, he can, you know, there's lots of other judges in the city. They can help him out and so on. So you take him away from that, and then that puts him sort of on his effectively on his own, or whoever is with him. They become a small unit. They can't call in a H-Wagon. They can't call in Riot Foam or whatever. Put him in a situation where it is dangerous. I mean, obviously, we know Dread's not going to get killed. Or is he? No, he's not. But
you've played that trick before, Mike. You can't do it twice.
But yeah, so you put Dread in a situation that is new to him. So he's, you know, he's all off familiar territory, and take away his support network, and then you see the real measure of the man. And in this case, the real measure of the man is a hard as nails bastard who will, you know, he will get the job done. That bit doesn't really change much. I made a story one day where Dread goes, it's too hard, and just walks away. So that's what I like about this. It was very hard to come up with the Jaya in the sense that we've already done pretty much everywhere on Earth. You can't keep putting him on, you know, sending him to different planets or different dimensions.
Sure.
So trying to find something that's on a place that's on Earth but hasn't been visited too often it was fun.
Yeah.
And also, again, taking Dread away from the city means that the artist then can play with new landscapes and textures and so forth. And as I said, when people see what Nick has done, they're going to be blown away. There's a few teaser images that have been released. They're a lick of the iceberg. That's what they are. This the rest of the stuff is fantastic. So.
Now, with the Righteous Man and the Gaia/Jaya, you're kind of dabbling in two different ways of doing Dread, where one is very much in continuity and the other is searching for something new within this the world that has been defined by that continuity. Can it be sometimes too tempting to rely on what's gone before? Because I know some readers don't like continuity-heavy stories, while others prefer ones that hark back to things that have gone before. Where do you kind of sit between the two?
Well, I don't think I'm pretty much halfway between the two. I like the idea of going back to Dread's early days and showing stuff that we've never seen, but knowing that it has to fit in with what comes up. I mean, that's very important. We can't suddenly decide that, I don't know, that there's another level of judges or something.
Sure.
The equivalent of the community police officers, we can't really do that. But at the same time, when you have limitations like that, it forces you to, as a writer, to come up with better ways of doing things. You write better with limitations than you do with complete freedom.
Mm.
When I was working on Jennifer Blood for an other publisher, my first task was to do a prequel series. And that was tough as anything, because she'd been established as a big character and so on. So I had to write stuff that fit in with what Garth Ennis and Al Ewing had done before me.
Mm.
And now, whether or not I succeeded, it's all really for me to say, except that I did. But that was extremely hard. Mm. But because it was hard, I came up with, I think, better stories and better ideas than I would have otherwise. Same with any limitations. For example, when we heard that John Magner was doing Day of Chaos, which of course meant screwing up Meg City 1 completely.
Mm.
That was horrible because a lot of us had Dread storylines, set up and ready to go, and other stuff, planned for the future. But by doing this, by destroying effectively 7/8 of Meg City 1, it forced me to come up with ideas that I never would have thought of before. Mm. And I'm sure it's the same for Gordon and for Robin, the other writers, that stuff would never would have occurred to us because we didn't have that limitation. My story, The Forsaken, which is about the missing cadets, never would have happened had John, not decided to do that. So, getting back to the point, continuity is very important, but at the same time, it's also important to try and fit things, if we're going back to the past, put in new stuff, flesh the past out a bit, but without negating anything that's gone before. Mm. But a couple of tiny exceptions, the ongoing argument as to whether or not Rico had Rico on his Dredge badge, or Dredd on his Judge badge. That's one I had to take a few liberties with when I was writing the Third Law of the Rico novel. Because, some of the early stuff, Rico had Dredd on his badge, and then later ones, the flashbacks go with Rico on his badge. Why is he the only judge with his first name on his badge? So we have to be aware of continuity, but not necessarily... you can't treat it as sacrosanct. You have to be wise about it.
Okay. We're at the beginning of a new year. You've already got two things coming out. What else does 2016 hold in store for Michael Carroll in 2008?
Well, yes, that's a very good question. Because you know the answer to this, don't you? You know what's coming up, the thing that we can't talk about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and German readers will notice that I said the thing we can't talk about with capital letters. you know what's coming, and we can't say nothing about it.
Yeah, well, people are just going to have to keep their ears and eyes open, aren't they?
They certainly are. But all I will say is that... can I say anything at all? I don't know. let's just say this... I'm not going to be very much liked on a particular episode. But I don't care. It's not about me. It's about the Dread. It's about the readers and the story. We have some big stuff coming up that I can't talk about. But hopefully at some point down the line, and this obviously has to be open to negotiation, I want to do more of the novellas.
Yep.
I'm not saying go as far as year three just yet, but there's still some mileage in the year two idea of Dredd being, under suspicion because his brother was corrupt, And also, I really want to go back to Rico's story on Titan. My original plan for that was to have three novels, so a trilogy, which would end effectively with Rico coming back to Earth and confronting Joe, which is the first time we ever saw Rico in the comics. So it would be that same story. That was the idea. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, the it depends on how well the Third Law has sold. Not fairly, I suspect. But, yeah, so I looked at that. And also, I'm still working on, of course, DeMarco, which is...
Yes, of course.
Jan Cleese is running at the moment in the magazine.
Yeah.
That's a four-parter. And we are by Steve Yeol again. And, yeah. I still get very fanboyish when the artwork comes in, because I'm a huge fan of Steve's work.
Sure.
Ever since the first episode of Zenith. Or Zenith for American listeners. So yeah, when the artwork comes in with my words but drawn by Stevie Yeol, I just go, oh, this is exciting. So yeah, that's the Dan Cleese, the DeMarco story is it's one of those ones that feeds on what's gone before and will feed into something in the future. But yeah, so there's that and the big thing that we don't talk about coming up. And after that, I don't really know. I have to see. Let's see what the impact is of various things and see where we go from there.
Brilliant.
You know, I've got all my plans, but all my plans have trapdoors just in case. So.
Well, with The Righteous Man out today, with the magazine, with both DeMarco PI and also the Gaia, or Jaya, starting, yeah. It's a Merry Carol 2016. Yeah, does that work?
Yes. It seems like a lot of the magazine was written by me, and I do apologise to all my non-fans for that. But for a while anyway, there'll be two stories by me. Wow.
Fantastic.
How did I get twice as many comp copies? Oh, we'll leave that one for another time, shall we?
Report to Metquake. Brilliant. Well, that's all the time we've got for chatting, Michael. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And yeah, really looking forward to getting my teeth into the stuff that you've written that's coming out pretty soon.
Thank you very much.
All right. So great to hear from Mike about the stuff he's got coming up in 2000 AD and from Abaddon Books. Just as a reminder, if you want to buy any of the 2000 AD prose novels and novellas, then rebellionstore.com is your place to go. You can get those DRM free in PDF and whatnot to download to your digital device, or they're all available on amazon.co.uk and amazon.com. Another of our regular writers, who's been with us a bit longer than Mr. Carroll has, is Ian Edgington. And we thought we'd get him on to talk about some of the stuff he's got coming up in 2016, including some more Brass Sun, some more Scarlet Traces, but also some stuff that has only just been announced in Tharg's Nerve Center in 2000 AD. So we're going to talk to him in a second about that. Just put in a reminder that... 2000 AD Prog 1963 is on shelves today, and we've got a new Judge Dredd magazine coming out next week. These can be bought from our apps, from our web store. You can also pick them up from newsagents in the UK, as well as comic book stores in the UK, North America, and around the world. We've got a fantastic roster of stories at the moment, including obviously Judge Dredd, but also Strontium Dog, ABC Warriors for anyone who's after a nostalgia kick. But also got newer series like Kingdom running, which, really great fun, some amazing artwork and writing, as always, from 2000 AD, the galaxy's greatest comic. Now, let's bring Ian in to talk about the stuff that he's got coming up in 2016 for 2000 AD. And he was a guest on the podcast last year, and it's a delight to welcome Ian Edgington back to the podcast in 2016. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Michael. A joy as ever.
Welcome back to the Thrillcast. I don't believe a word you just said. So, 2016, you've got quite a bit of stuff coming up, haven't you?
Yes, all by luck and judgment, but yes, which is nice. The mortgage provider and my wife and children are quite pleased that money is coming into the house. So yes, but yeah, no, it's kind of it's been a fruition of like long-term plans and things at various degrees of development, and they've all kind of like gathered together at this point. So it does seem as though 2016 is going to be quite busy, which is good. It's being freelance, so being busy is no bad thing.
Well, let's talk about Scarlet Traces. At the end of last year, we announced that we have actually bought the rights to Scarlet Traces from yourself and Matt Brooker, a.k.a. Disraeli. Describe a little bit about what Scarlet Traces was, and then we'll move on to where we're going to take it in the future.
Okay, it's an idea I had way back when, before I started writing and everything. And I always wondered, because the Martians in War of the Worlds invaded Britain, and of course Britain being an island, what happened to all that technology afterwards? And so it was only when I actually started to be a writer and things like that, I thought, I'm come back to that idea. And basically, of course, the industrious Victorians would attempt to reverse engineer it. And so we've got a society now that's technologically advanced, more advanced than the rest of the world, because they're thriving off what they can derive from Martian technology and so on. And so the British the sun never set on the British Empire and so on. And so the first Scarlet Traces book is essentially a murder mystery. The second one, The Great Game, which takes place in that world's 1940s, is a war story, a grim and gritty war story from a photojournalist's point of view. And then the new one, the next instalment, is actually going to be set in that world's 1960s. So we'll have jumped on another 20 odd years from then and seen how the world and England has developed and the cultural impact of the Martians and all that. So it's kind of like War of the Worlds kind of dropped a stone in the pond, and the Scarlet Traces stories are the ripples going outwards.
Well, just your mention of 1960s makes me think kind of. Maybe Cold War-y, John le Carré kind of feel thing?
Sort of. It's kind of it's a little reflective of what's going on now with kind of modern day colonialism and wars in countries for things because we want their resources and blah. And so there's kind of echoes of that, but also it's basically there's nothing new under the sun. The things that are going on in the news happened in the 60s, and it's all to do with imperialism and expansionism and stuff like that. So there's echoes of that. It's not going to overpower the story, but that's kind of like the big thing at the back, and it's the characters at the front that we're going to follow. I don't know how much of the story I want to give away, because I'm really quite pleased with some of the stuff with Matt and I have come up with. So I kind of want to save some revelations. But yeah, so it's the teaser is that actually at the end of War of the Worlds, it was cited that Martian cylinders were actually being launched from Mars and actually heading towards Venus.
Right.
So we pick up on that thread kind of thing, what's happened in the interim. On Venus kind of thing, because we know what happened in Scarlet Traces, a great game. We know what happened on Mars, it was like all devastation and so on. So it's the cause and effect of that. So for a long time, I fancied writing the sequel, and I really didn't have much of the ideas percolating. And then some bits and bobs and influences came in from all around. I noted them down, and actually there's a makings of quite a juicy story here. So it's like it's taken a few years to ferment, but I'm kind of in the mood now, in the groove.
In the groove.
Yes.
The decision of you and Matt to sell the rights to 2080, I mean, that in itself is very unusual. What was your thinking behind that? Because normally, the way things have been going in comics for some time is that creators want to keep hold of their rights, but here you are selling them to us.
That's right. We did have them with Dark Horse for quite a while, and they treat us really nice. I mean, we couldn't speak higher of them. And we talked on and off over a few years about doing an omnibus that collected all the series and then doing something new. And it never really came to anything. And time was dragging on, and it was years in the end. It was like a couple of years. And I just said to Matt, look, the majority of our work is with yourselves. Mm. We've, yes, you kind of like, you own a lot of stuff, but we've always had a really good deal, really good working relationship. Nobody else has worked on our stuff without our permission, our permission. Mm. Like Ian Hallward did a Stickleback story, that kind of thing. Matt was okay with that. So we just thought, well, this is where we're happiest. We've got no complaints. We're making a deal with people we know. We know what we're getting into. And a lot of people have said, they can't get hold of the collections, and they've been asking when there are going to be reprints and things. And so this guarantees there'll be reprints out there. There'll be some new material. because the Great Game book actually got cut short a little bit. It got trimmed down from 6 to 5 issues. So we're going to see if we can insert some extra pages there to actually make the story a little more expansive the way it should have been. And then we get to do not just one more new series, but in essence, we can do Scarlet Tracy now in perpetuity, because there's a linear story, but also it's a huge world, you know, where everything's been affected. It's, you know, it's kind of so. There are more stories to tell, definitely. And so just thought we'll bring it here. And the other point as well is that somewhere like Image, you know, yes, we've done creator owned stuff and things, but it's with Rebellion, with yourselves, 2000 AD, we can actually do, you know, a number of series. I mean, if you take, for example, Red Seas, Steve Yonite, that we did nearly 1,000 pages of comic artwork, comic story. Mm. Now, you know, where would you get to that? And so, you know, and we'll give them a little flag, say, okay, you know, we need to wind it up over the next couple of series, and so we built up towards that. So it all kind of like fitted, you know, it closed off quite nicely, and it's a huge body of work. Mm. And so we have the opportunity here to actually do a lot more stuff to expand the world, you know, to go sideways with the story. And so we just thought, okay, you know, to sell it is the price we'll pay. But, you know, we're getting a good deal. We're getting more work out of it. People get to see more stories. I'm happy with the deal. We're both happy. We sat down and talked long and hard about it, and we just said, no. And all of a sudden, as well, Rebellion become the repository of like the greatest amount of our work. Along with Stuckleback and everything else, you know, and Helium and stuff. It's like, and Leviathan, it's like, okay. So all of a sudden, the huge, you know, we become a major contributor to your ranks overnight.
Well, talking about Red Seas, of course, the entire thing is available in two digital editions that are available from our web shop and apps. And as you say, it is a massive body of work.
Smoothly done, I thought. I love the way you seeped into that seamlessly.
Anybody would think I worked in marketing. So just to round off talking about Scarlet Traces, we've earlier on in this episode, we talked to Michael Carroll, who has a new Dread prose novella coming out this week. I understand that there's also going to be a Scarlet Traces novel to tie in the whole thing.
It would seem so. I'm being milked thoroughly.
The images. My brain burns.
Now we discussed doing it. Obviously, the Scarlet Tracy world is a huge world, and so we're actually kind of setting a. I'm going to set a novel before the original Scarlet Tracy series about how the British authorities basically they have a captive Martian that they use as a primer for working out how all the technology works. And so it's the story of like how he came to be, how there was a Martian survivor, and the story that leads all the way up to that. So it's kind of a murder mystery thriller steampunky thing set in like post alien invasion London, so where the city's recovering and murder victims are turning up with strange wounds upon their body, and the, you know, government coming in from one hand, the policemen from another, and various things. So it slots quite neatly between War of the Worlds, the adaptation, and the first Scarlet Tracy book, and answer some questions. And it'll set up lots of threads that will go not just into The Great Game, but also into the third series and beyond. It's a nice opportunity to come up to retrofit the story that we'd already done, and like cast new plot threads out that we can pick up later on, that make it look as if we meant to do that all along, and that we are smarter than we in fact we are.
Marvelous. So,
but that's fun. I mean, I've written some short fiction. I did Sherlock Holmes story for the Abaddon's Beyond 221 Baker Street, and I want to kind of get into doing more prose. And so this was an ample opportunity to kind of have a go.
Yeah, it's nice with a band that we can sort of, you know, expand on the comics world, but in prose.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's good. It's a new routine as well. You know, writing prose for me. So it's I'm having fun actually. Tomorrow of the world. So I mean, so you'll know more about that than I will, because it's you're dealing with all that kind of publishy thing over there in your end. I'm just the one putting the words on the paper. So
in theory, at least.
Yes.
But talking about sort of ongoing series and expansive world, Brass Sun is due a return, I feel, to our pages relatively soon. 2015, you had a new series of that running. I was very, very impressed, and I know a lot of other people were very impressed as well, as how Ren as a character has changed so much over the course. It's almost remarkable that you're watching her grow up on the page, and for that to happen in any comic strip is excellent. But in a kind of sci-fi fantasy space opera kind of thing, that's even rarer. I mean, where are you going to take this now? Where's next for Brass Sun?
Well, we have to wind up where they are at the minute. They're kind of they're free from their kind of the evil nuns that kind of like got them, and so they have to find a way off they're inside one of the big planetary spars that connect the planets to the sun. So they need to get off there. So that's the focus of the next series. And of course, Arthur, who was the evil android, has kind of he's had a change of programming, so to speak. So he'll kind of we'll see more of him on their side. And then the third series, which, because basically Ian and I now decided, okay, three series will make up a trade. We're going to pace ourselves as a, you know, do it as a whole novel kind of thing, as opposed to just ending each series. So it gives us a bit more kind of breathing space. You know, we can be more expansive in the storytelling. So, but the third book, we actually go to a world called Tall Green, which is basically massively like Avatar on steroids, basically. And so, because we actually saw the Mother Superior, we actually realized wasn't quite human. When her head opened, she had this kind of like plant-like bud thing inside her head. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to find out more about that. And we also find out more about Merlin, the big kind of like difference engine supercomputer kind of thing, about why he's kind of gone bonkers and wants to hunt them down and so on. And so it's we they're all going to be self-contained kind of adventures, but it's leading us along the same path. And the plan has always been, you know, she's not going to solve the mystery of all tomorrow. You know, she could well be into her 30s by the time it's done, because it's taking centuries for the wheel of worlds to wind down. So it doesn't all have to be solved in, you know, 1 hour, 45 minutes. So we can have ups and downs. Friends become villains, villains become friends, people come in. And so it's, you know, we've really still only in the early stages, but it's the grown-up's quite interesting, because it's a lot of it is kind of mirrored by my little girl. She's nine now. And it's just seeing her change, and just her like maturity in some respects, and the way she's kind of developed and grown, and it's quite interesting, like putting that into the character. It's like, oh, you know, things that I would never have noticed before, and it's quite enlightening. And so she's partly responsible for Ren, some of the idiosyncratic things she does. So, and also again, it's kind of, I wanted to write something that, you know, had a female protagonist that kind of we deliberately set out that she's not pretty, she's awkward, she's cantankerous, she's angry, you know, because she's had to leave her family behind. She's, you know, she's not the perfect heroine, but kind of, she knows she's got a job, and so she kind of like plows forward. And it's, you know, she learns along the way, you know, what you know, growing up. So it's a strange world to grow up in.
We've talked before about your Pipe and Slippers Gothic idea of treating literature, British literature, and comic characters and comic settings in a certain way. Is that where you're comfortable? Because there seems to be a common thread all the way through things like Helium, you know, airships on a poison planet, Brass Sun, vast, great big sci-fi setting, but still very much that kind of, I mean, we dubbed it clock punk. You've also got things like Scarlet Traces, which is a kind of steampunk thing. There seems to be a common theme throughout all of your writing for us.
And I think that's one of the things why I like working for Rebellion. It's kind of, and you can send me the check later, is that I've done stuff for DC. I am doing some stuff for DC still, and I've done things for Marvel in the past and stuff like that. And now I'm 52 now, and I'm kind of thinking, well, you know, I want to write the stuff I like and I enjoy, and I like, you know, intelligent, pulpy, action adventure fiction, and that's kind of that's where my heart lay, kind of thing. You know, it's I had a bad bout of glandular fever when I was growing up, and basically, you know, and there were three channels on television at the time, so that was no good. So it was just really
luxury.
Yeah, so it was like Sherlock Holmes, and it was, you know, Conan Doyle, it was all, John Wyndham, all that kind of stuff that kind of, you know, embedded itself in my kind of like literary DNA.
Mm.
So it kind of informs what I do. I have done kind of other stuff outside of this, but it's what I like. I mean, I'm probably going to write myself out of it in a bit. I'll kind of be a bit fed up with it and kind of want to do something else. I mean, one of the other things we're going to talk about, Kingmaker, is different, and there's I've got a horror story as well that's a bit further down the line, called Cell Count, that's going to be coming up a bit later on in your publishing schedule. But but then primarily, yeah, this is kind of like it's the thing I like to write, and I think it's, I don't know, maybe it's just I'm an old fart. This is the kind of stuff I like.
The reason I ask is 2014, I went to a convention with Lee Gallagher in Malta, where we happened to have a lot of spare time on our hands. And so we were chatting away, and he was coming towards the... he knew he was coming towards the end of Defoe with Pat Mills. And that last episode ran at the very tail end of last year in the last prog before the Christmas special. And he was saying that, you know, he's had a good run on Aquila and Defoe, but he wanted more sci-fi stuff. You know, that was all history stuff. He wanted more sci-fi stuff. And I said, well, why don't you ask Matt if there's anything out there? Why don't you find a writer that he's willing to do it? And then in a prog this week, last week, Matt Smith mentioned Kingmaker.
Yes.
Which is Lee described to me as Aliens versus Middle Earth, which, yes, sounds suitably different to the kind of pipe and slippers gothic thing. It's quite a while until that's going to be debuting in the prog, but tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was just one of those random ideas, just sitting down and watching like the end of Lord of the Rings. I'm just thinking, wouldn't it be ironic if, you know, just as Frodo's about to, that basically the entire place just got blitzed and Independence Day ships came in, and it's just like, you know, so much for sound. I thought, there's an idea there. It's cheap and exploitational, but there's an idea there. And so, in essence, that's what it is. It's kind of a classic Middle Earthy kind of planet, and just basically they think they've got problems, and also an aliens invade.
Hmm.
It's, you know, what the planet, the inhabitants think is magic is actually a resource. The physical resource in itself that these people want, these creatures, want. And so all of a sudden, you know, what you find, orcs having to side with elves and goodness knows what, you know, all allegiances completely are up in the air and changing because suddenly they've got a bigger nemesis to kind of like deal with. And in essence, the war's over. The alien invaders have in essence won, and the people there are being occupied.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a way of kind of, there's a thread, a way to defeat them. It's not a meter wide exhaust port or anything like that, but it's kind of,
is it a computer virus or an actual virus?
Yes, it's a computer virus. there is a means to defeating them, but it's kind of the only person who's seen it is like this orc captain called Crixus. And of course, the running gag is nobody trusts orcs. And he gets really, like, as soon as they meet the elf people, he's got this great story to tell. It's like, look, I know where the way. And the first thing I want to do is try and kill him because, like, he's an orc kind of goblin. And he's like, oh, fuck. And it's just like, you know, it's like, and so, and then, and of course, the allegiances are all turned up and down as well. So people you thought you could trust, you can't. And it's quite surprising. And basically, Lee just said, you know, just stick. I said, what do you want? What do you want me to write? What do you want? I want spaceships and dragons. He went, okay, that's not in the story, but I'm putting spaceships and dragons in.
Cool, he doesn't ask for much, does he?
So I can't change the end of one script, basically. So there's a dogfight between spaceships and dragons in what he wants, just because that's what he wants. It's just loose and silly and fun and kind of, you know, there's some emotional heartspring tugging moments in there and stuff. But mainly it's just kind of, like I say, you know, intelligent pulpy action adventure fiction. And just a laugh, basically. It's just kind of, I want to take some of the trope, those kind of, you know, fancy-ish tropes and kind of turn them around. And so that's my kind of, I'm just stamping all over Tolkien, basically. So
I'm all for that. I like anything that kind of subverts cliches in fiction. Let's talk about your collaborators for a minute, because you know, you've got two amazing series with Disraeli.
Yes.
You've got Brasson with
With Ian Corbett. Yes, I've been very lucky, because and they're great guys to work with, and because I've worked with some artists who have been nice people, but they've kind of just gone in their own, especially on some American stuff. Sometimes what they'll do, one or two artists that I noticed have done, they've taken the signature image on a page and blown it up to like a big spread, and then everything else is fitted around it.
Right.
And kind of, but where Ian and Matt kind of like draw to complement the story.
Mm.
With Ian, I like to leave lots of shoulder room, because he's got kind of very much about broad gestures. Mm. But with Matt, he's kind of like the blinding detail, basically. You know, it's like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin kind of thing. So I'm all right with 11 and 15 pages panels on a page. Don't worry, that's all. And then you do it and he curses you. But
There's the whole thing about with 2000 AD, obviously we're a magazine size, so there's more space to play with, and he crams a load of detail in. But then when we were talking about the Great Game, I remember reading that when Dark Horse brought out the individual floppy issues, and reduced down, it's almost as if he fits even more detail.
I know.
On a smaller page. It's incredible.
He's like some little scrivener there with kind of like little thick lens glasses, putting little tiny dots and engraving things. Yeah, I mean, he's. I remember when he started doing Stickleback, which he's done in that very unique style, and it took him ages to do the first year. And he kind of like narrowed down the time period it takes to do a page. But even so, it's kind of he likes to punish himself in a good way.
I was going to ask about Stickleback, because the last series, and no spoilers for those who haven't read it, I really do recommend you go and pick up the two trades, because I read them all in one go. And yeah, it's a fantastic story with a terrific cliffhanger. Without giving too much away, where are you going to take Stickleback? What's the next kind of phase?
Well, we need to do another series to make it a trade's worth. Mm. So we're kind of talking about where we're going to go with that. We've had a major revelation at the end of the last series, and so we're going to basically that character who is majorly revealed will kind of take over. He'll still be called Stickleback, but he'll take over being like the primary character kind of thing, and he'll still resort to the Stickleback persona kind of thing. Because the world now has been occupied by these kind of Lovecraftian creatures, it's kind of the Stickleback will now become like a rallying cry for a resistance kind of thing.
Mm.
So we're kind of like heading in that direction. So we've kind of laid out roughly another series, the plan for another series. So there'll be a trade's worth, and then we're kind of like looking to the future. We kind of know where we're going to be. We kind of set up our storyline for the next couple of series after that. So it's Matt kind of wants to get on to doing Scarlet Traces first. He's kind of, because he's going to be busy the year after, so we're concentrating on getting as much Stickleback done as we can, Scarlet Traces done as we can,
sure,
this year. So it's going to be a busy year. So
brilliant. One thing that we sort of did some stuff on last year that hasn't seen print yet is, of course, the story with the parody of Nigel Farage, which is Dave Taylor drawing Judge Dredd with with you. 2080 has a long history of parodying politicians of all hues. Why pick on what would seem to be an obvious target like Nigel Farage?
Because he's an obvious target like Nigel Farage. The man is f***ing clown shoes. I'm sorry, excuse me, Siren. He just is. He's just obnoxious and just ripe for parody and kind of. And that the 2008, the Megacity One and Dread and stuff has always been a brilliant backdrop on which to tell these kind of stories. Allegories kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so it just fitted hand in glove, really. And it's just kind of. And yeah, why not? just why not? Because it's there, and it's kind of like, you know, he shouldn't stick his head above the parapet if he didn't want rocks thrown at him. So I've got a bag of rocks here for when he comes out to that.
Yeah, exactly. Metaphorical and physical.
Yes. So yeah, no, it was just kind of, it was like an obvious target, but it also was a good excuse to tell a really silly, stupid, spiky story. And fit it quite nicely in that world. And I just, it's just a cheap joke, but it was some of those can be the funniest.
Well, Ian, We've run out of time. I want to thank you for taking so long to talk to us, and really looking forward to more Scarlet Traces, which I think was the first thing of yours that I ever read, and loved it, and especially looking forward to Kingmaker later in the year. So yeah, thanks very much for coming.
You're
on
welcome.
The Millcast.
Take care.
So that's another 2000 AD Thrillcast Earthlets. Thank you so much for listening to us, and thank you to Michael and to Ian for joining us and telling us about some of the awesome things that they've got coming up in 2016. Next time, in 14 days, the Thrillcast celebrates its first birthday. Yes, the award-winning official podcast of 2000 AD is 1 year old, and both myself and Mechanoise will be celebrating with a special little edition in which we promise we will not get drunk in any way, shape or form to celebrate 12 months of bringing you the best aural entertainment from the galaxy's greatest comic that we can. So until then, Squawk Stick Thargo everywhere, Splendid Verthrig. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Remember, Earthlets, don't be a Grexnix, Splundig Verthrig!